Coming up on Tech Nation, I speak with MIT professor David Mindell, co-founder of U-matics and author of Our Robots, Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. He's out to dispel the persistent misconceptions about robots. No worries, R2-D2 and C-3PO are still great robots. Then on Biotech Nation, what biotech has been working on to treat diseases which primarily affect young boys. Well known is hemophilia, less so the debilitating Duchenne muscular dystrophy. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In my Tech Nation interview with Jerry Kaplan, the author of Humans Need Not Apply, he makes the point that artificial intelligence systems act in the interest of their owners, regardless of their effect on you. That's right, their effect on you. I think it's a lesson that applies across the board when it comes to technology, and possibly anything human for that matter. If you can't see the consequences of your behavior, you assume your behavior is good, and if not, certainly well-intentioned. Take a conversation I had recently where we were discussing how a particular piece of clothing was so great and yet cost so little, and it just couldn't be pushed out of a machine. And then we came to an unexpected silence. It had been touched by human hands, far away, unseen, living conditions, unknown and unknowable. Since we didn't think any of this in that music-filled, well-lit, happy place this well-turned-out toddler shirt was purchased in, the distance from its creators kept us away from considering the effect of being the willing purchasers. Knowing the effect of your use of technology, well, that could be a new Tech Nation rule of reality in the 21st century. But let's get back to artificial intelligence, the internet, and all things digital. We're in the Wild West when it comes to building anything information-wise. Think about it. Enabling your mobile phone to work means that your mobile phone provider knows where you are, or rather where it is, and in my case, I prefer my smartphone to be with me at all times. It's an ancillary piece of data, a byproduct of providing the service. When it's needed, such as when you leave your phone behind, say in a taxi, and you want to be able to track it. But if someone else wants to establish where you are, or where you were, without you knowing it, now that's an invasion of privacy. But let's face it, the fact is the technology tracks us, and it's central to the technology working. The data is there, just waiting to be used by someone. But this still is different from what Jerry Kaplan was talking about. The idea with artificial intelligence, as it applies to our personal use of the internet, is to affect our behaviors. It's not just to discover what our behaviors are and follow that, but rather to induce us to act in a particular way, without our consciously knowing it. Let's face it, that's been the implicit activity ever since the birth of modern-day advertising. And it continues on today on the internet, with every touch of your keyboard, every click of your mouse, every app that you use. So what's the right thing to do? That's a tough one. It's the difference between what's ethical and what's legal, but most things are legal. And most actions are in limbo until you think about them. Nothing is unethical in your own mind until you think about it. So let's try this on for size. How about if you are collecting data on people, you have to let them know. You have to let them know what you can deduce from it, and when it is being recorded, and how long you have it. And here's the tricky one. What is your intent? I don't think anyone is going to go for this, but there's no harm in trying. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with MIT professor David Mindell about robots today, what they are capable of, and what we might rethink, whether it's driverless cars or predator drones. Then on Biotech Nation, biotech works on diseases primarily affecting young boys, both hemophilia and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. One of the reasons MIT professor David Mindell wrote his book, Our Robots, Ourselves, is to dispel the persistent misconceptions about robots. I asked him, is there anything wrong with R2-D2 and C-3PO?
Nothing's wrong with them. I think, in fact, they illustrate a good example of robots operating in social environments and engaging in social relationships and working very well in connection with their human users and doing things their human users wish and aid them to do. In fact, one of the projects I'm working for on DARPA is very explicitly modeled on a kind of R2-D2 in the back of Luke Skywalker's X-Wing. How do you help the pilot accomplish goals without taking the job away from her?
Oh, good. You dropped that her in there. That's very good. We appreciate that.
Always with pilots. There's both genders.
But R2-D2 and C-3PO, they're guys, right?
Yeah.
I knew that. But robots don't have to be guys.
No. We project a lot of things onto robots. We project a lot of things onto objects in general. There's a long history of automata and artificial life and golems and wonderful mythology around Pinocchio and many other stories like that. But I think sometimes those stories maybe get in the way of how we're actually learning to use robots in the real world.
So now, what are you defining? What's your framework for what qualifies as a robot?
Well, I'm not all that rigid about it, and I talk about more generally robots and autonomous systems. And I point out in the book that actually airliners are a lot like robots that you sit in. Your interaction with various kinds of software systems is very similar to the way that people interact with robots. Although I do focus on machines that have motions in the real world and do something in the physical world as opposed to purely software systems. And one of the aspects of those machines is they can kill you or they can kill other people. So the stakes are pretty high. And when the stakes are that high, a lot of the issues that you see on smaller scale but you may be willing to live with when you're operating a word processor, you're not willing to live with when you're flying an airliner.
And I have to tell you that if you ever look at an industrial robot handbook on the cover, it almost always says, warning, this robot may kill or maim. It's like right up front, you are talking about something that can operate fast, very, very quickly with full force, and you won't even see it coming.
That's certainly true. And, you know, you go into a factory and you see those robots and they're marked off by yellow tape, you know, 20, 30 feet away from them. And they're not very good in working within human environments for some reasons that we understand. And the future has got to be more of integrating those kind of machines into human settings, social settings in general, and both those kind of settings are almost by definition economic settings.
I have to say I was really interested in how you integrated a number of issues together. It's not just about robots. And I know with all the excitement about driverless cars, I was interested to see you write, what the Google car proponents have missed, and many in the technology press have also overlooked, is that the liability, certification, and risk issues are not incidental society issues that stand in the way of otherwise independent invention. Rather, liability, certification, and risk are crucial parts of the question of autonomy. And that's A-U-T-O-N-O-M-Y, autonomy or autonomous we're talking about, and crucially involved in framing the future of our robots and ourselves. It's not just a technical issue. It's about who is in control. Boy, that's the punchline. who is in control?
I think that's certainly true. And, you know, if you look at, again, liability, risk, trust, these are all pieces of the kind of social software that has to surround any new technology for it to make inroads. And they're very much related to what's going on right down into the detailed levels of the code. So there are engineers who build autonomous cars who are themselves setting thresholds of what's safe, setting cost functions that the car has to use to weigh efficiency versus performance versus safety. Those are things you do unconsciously in your brain every time you drive. Maybe you're late and you turn up your mental risk knob a little bit and you drive a little more aggressively. Maybe you pick your kids up at school and you turn your mental risk knob down and it's okay to take a little slower way to go, or you're in an unfamiliar environment. And those decisions are all getting made by the people who write the software anyway. And all I'm arguing for is that we should figure out ways to bring those decisions under the driver's control rather than embedded and hidden behind some corporate firewall.
I keep thinking that if you were on the show, David, like 3 or 4 months ago, this would have kind of been words, words, words falling on deaf ears. But then we have Volkswagen with, software. You know, it's like, are we driving fast but the steering wheel isn't turning? Ooh, we must be on the test stand, so let's emit this level versus, well, we'll just give you good gas mileage and emit away.
Right.
You know, that was totally engineering software.
I'm glad you bring that up because it's not really a story about autonomy so much, but it's certainly a story about software embedded in your car. And it's a story about, I'm not a Volkswagen diesel driver, but you can ask one, what's it like to feel like the software in your car is made by a company that doesn't share the values that you share? And all software embeds human values in one way or another, consciously or unconsciously. And when we think about autonomy and driving, what are those values that are going to be embedded in our software? And how transparent are they going to be? And then what are the ways that you may have to be able to ensure that what you're buying is really what you get? That we don't do a great job of doing that with a lot of the software we use today. And I think it's a good idea to think that through as we get into not just controlling your emissions from your car, which many people find very important, but also controlling your life and how fast you go and what lane you're in and all the other aspects of driving, which right now are not entirely under our control, but much more under our control.
Well, we have individuals now who go down and get a driver's license, and they got to pass a written test that they know what the rules are, and they got to pass a driving test demonstrating to another human they can do all the basic things and they can do it sufficiently. Then we take our cars down and we register them, and at most you kind of kick the tires or, you know, it looks real. We have to take a look at it. And you've got like an emissions test in California, at least that's what we have. And it seems to me that the more software and technology we put in those cars, we're putting what we are testing the humans about into the cars. So where does that get licensed? Where does that get certified?
Right, and how do you certify it? And that's a
from manufacturer to manufacturer, they're all
absolutely
working on it.
And how do you know how to operate them if you switch from one manufacturer to another manufacturer? The claim of autonomy is a claim that the car knows what it's doing and is doing something that is maybe unpredictable. That's already been discussed and analyzed at great length in other kinds of software systems. How do you certify things that are unpredictable? In the airline world, Boeing and Airbus, they make the software predictable. And there's a very long, very expensive and very extensive testing and certification process. Takes a long time. It means the technology moves slower.
You mean for auto landing and things
auto
like
land, autopilots, fly by wire, all that stuff. It doesn't mean it's free of bugs, but it does a decent job of certificating the software. What are we going to do for autonomous driving? How are we going to make sure that a car doesn't veer off into the wrong lane? Already this week, it's funny. The book came out just a week ago now, and the same day or the day after, Tesla announced its new kind of on-the-highway autonomy driving autopilot system, and they released it as a software update to its cars. And in general, from what I know of that system, it's basically pretty well designed and leaves the drivers in, the ability to come back and intervene. But within 24 hours, you had users who were very big fans of their Tesla cars and of the company uploading scary episodes of, you know, the radar on the front lost lock of the car in front of me, and it locked onto the car coming at me and veered into the other lane, and I had to grab the wheel and pull back. I think that's the right way to do it. You really got to keep the driver alert and able to take over, and hopefully those things will get worked out without anybody getting hurt or getting killed. But the claim that a car is going to be fully autonomous and that you'll be sleeping in the trunk in the back while your kids are strapped in, really, you really need to have 110% trust in that software. And my book is full of 30, 40 deeply researched empirical examples about how when lives have been on the line and there's really the stakes are very high, people have tended to put those human interventions back in the story. And that's something I think we need to really take seriously as we look forward at what is the role of the driver in the future computer-aided car.
Well, I don't believe we can have anything fully autonomous. And I say that for a really simple rule, and that is all technology fails. It's a matter of time and circumstance. Unless you programmed in either the algorithm, or even if it's a learning algorithm, it can only learn the way you've told it to in the situations it has. If it's encountered a new circumstance and fails, now it can now learn again, except the stakes are too high. People are in that car.
That's certainly true. There are we know there are always failures. There are sensor failures. There are software upgrades that don't get done. There are maintenance failures. I flew out here from Boston on a, you know, probably $100 million airliner, which has certified software and certified pilots and certified maintenance. We still don't allow the pilots to go to sleep while that airplane is on autopilot for 6 hours flying across the country. How we think we're going to achieve that with a $30,000 car that drives around in the mud and the muck with us drivers who are barely trained is there's not a lot of evidence to say we're going to get there anytime soon. Moreover, there's always some wrapper of human control around any autonomous system. You've got to direct it. You've got to tell it what to do. Where do you want to go? And the claim of full autonomy is really a claim that the engineers have understood everything possible about the world before you ever get in the car. But we know from, you know, many, many different studies of how technologies are used in the world that the users who are on the front line who are encountering the real world have something to say. They have something to add. The world, what's so wonderful about it, it's always surprising, always presents us with new situations, always evolving. And why would we want to eliminate the person, A, whose neck is on the line, and B, who's out there closest to the action?
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is MIT professor David Mendel, co-founder of U-Matics. With engineering experience in the field of undersea robotic exploration, he's a veteran of more than 30 oceanographic expeditions. You may know him as the author of such books as Digital Apollo, Human and Machine in Spaceflight. And he's here today with Are Robots Ourselves? Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. Well, one thing I was amazed at is, and I sort of knew intuitively, is that it's not just, we have a circumstance, we better be able to turn it over to the humans. Humans love to take control of the vehicles even when the technology works. You point out Neil Armstrong and the lunar lander during Apollo 11 and numerous other examples like that.
Yeah, the Apollo 11 is a great example. And, you know, there was what I learned from studying that example, and that was what my previous book that you mentioned, Digital Apollo, was about. At the time, the Soviets' spacecraft had lower-tech analog computers. And because they had lower-tech analog computers, they were actually much more highly automated, and they allowed much less input from the astronauts. The American computers for the Apollo program, which were very far-reaching, kind of cutting-edge, new digital fly-by-wire software-based systems, actually, because of all that advanced technology, they were in some ways less automated, but built a much more custom-designed, flexible, adaptive system that allowed the astronauts to get exactly the right level of control at any given moment, which sometimes meant they had automatic flight on sometimes meant they turned it off. When Armstrong reached over and turned off the automatic targeting a few minutes before the Apollo 11 landing.
Which he didn't have to do.
Which he didn't necessarily have to do, but he had that option and he felt it was important at the time. And he didn't even, you know, the legend goes, oh, he turned off the computer and landed it by hand. Not true at all. He landed in a very semi-automated fly-by-wire mode, attitude hold in his right hand, rate of descent in his left hand with a switch. Very, very kind of subtly tuned custom automation to what he felt was necessary at the time. After he did that on Apollo 11, all six commanders, all five who followed him, did exactly the same thing. And it's hard to argue with, all six attempts at landing that system on the moon were successful.
And explain to people what fly-by-wire means.
Fly-by-wire is most modern airliners work this way. And that's where there are no direct mechanical connections between the pilots, controls, and the things that flap on the outside of the airplane, the ailerons and rudder and whatnot. Instead, the pilot is using his or her hands to control the airplane, but it goes through the computer. The computer maybe filters, maybe adapts, maybe imposes some constraints on what the pilot's doing, and then uses software to control the control surfaces on the outside of the plane. So the computer is kind of centrally mediating that story. And there's a lot of interesting different ways to do that. Airbus and Boeing do it differently, but it is the way that most new airliners fly today.
Now let's talk Predator drones. There's no human on board, but that doesn't mean there isn't a pilot.
That's right. So the Predator story is a very rich, very interesting, and I think very important story. An aircraft that was designed and originally conceived as an unmanned drone. Go out, fly the mission, and come back. So much so that the engineers who designed it back in the 80s and 90s, they put no thought into the ground control station, the user interface. Why would you need a ground control station for a vehicle that's autonomous? And what happened after 9/11, as this system was kind of, and through the 90s too in the Kosovo conflict, as the system became useful for things completely other than what it was designed for, i.e. real-time video, persistent surveillance on a particular point of interest, the users had to kind of add and jimmy up and modify the system to the point where what we have today and for the last 10 years or so is these remote split operations where you have crews in darkened trailers in Las Vegas or other parts of the U.S. controlling through satellite links these unmanned aircraft that are far away. But the unmanned aircraft are not making decisions on their own. They're not launching missiles on their own. They have some automated features that allow them to fly in a circle, or they certainly use autopilots. But they're very much remotely controlled systems. So much so that the crews, even though they're physically not present above the battlefield, because they're watching the people who they're either attacking or supporting, in the case of friendly troops, for many, many hours at a time, find themselves deeply immersed in the situations of combat. They experience post-traumatic stress disorder at about the same rate that pilots who fly above the battlefield do. But it's a different kind of experience. They don't get medals for their work. They don't get flight pay. They don't get combat pay. The Air Force and the military is very conflicted about what's their status as warriors. But there's no question that they're deeply present in the environments that they're working in.
And you write also that there is a stigma regarding the Predator, being a member of the Predator crew. It's not like being a fighter pilot.
That's certainly true, and they're often kind of derided as Nintendo warriors or armchair warriors. And, you know, the social structures around warfare are very strong, and they've grown up over a very long period of time, I think for very good reason. I mean, you have to control violence in a way that it doesn't destroy your own organization. But this remote sense of warfare where the body is not at risk, although the body and the soul may be at risk still, is not something that we've been well prepared to deal with, especially as it's evolved since 9/11 in an environment of stress, combat, warfare, very complex politics. And one thing that those vehicles are not is killer robots. They don't make any decisions on their own. They have some basic kind of get home if I lose communication behaviors, but for the most part, they're still very tightly controlled.
Well, I think it's worth noting that until several hundred years ago, we were talking about hand-to-hand combat, very close quarters. You know, so then we get the catapult. You're kind of away, but you can throw. You could still see the enemy. And we've been in this myth of sort of, we're further and further away. We can't see. Someone flies over, drops a bomb. You know, and it's like you can't even see what happened. Now we're wildly remote, half a world away, but we actually can see. And the effects of knowing and seeing clearly are there.
That's certainly true. And the debate over Predator is, as you point out, a very old debate. In fact, my first book, which was somewhat inspired by the kind of smart bombs that we saw landing in the 1991 Gulf War, is about ironclad warships in the American Civil War. And in 1862, you see people writing about, are we really warriors if we are fighting from inside a machine protected by 8 inches of armor plate? And what is the future going to be when all warfare is conducted remotely by machinery? These were things that people have very much on their mind at the time. A lot of similar phenomenon you see come up around the Predator operators. You know, warfare is a social experience. It's a ennobling one and violent one and all kinds of other things, but it's fundamentally about the relationships between people, whether they're friendly or hostile. And when machinery pushes those relationships too far away, it starts to get problematic. I mean, I think at some level, you just saw this in the whole nuclear age. If the goal of warfare was just to wipe out a whole country, we have the means to do that. But it doesn't tend to be what accomplishes the goals. And thank goodness we haven't chosen to do that.
Now, one place in which robots are essential for exploration, as the place is not overly friendly for human habitation, is deep in the ocean. Tell us about how robots are being used there.
So this is where the book really opens, because my career opened in the deep ocean. And in the 1980s, when we were just beginning to replace, we ended up augmenting manned submersibles. You've probably heard of the famous submersible Alvin that Woods Hole operated since the 1960s, sending 3 people to the seafloor.
I'm speaking with MIT professor David Mindell. His book is Our Robots, Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, what biotech has been working on for diseases which primarily affect young boys, from hemophilia to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with MIT professor David Mindell, co-founder of U-Matics and author of Our Robots, Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy.
In the 1980s, when we were just beginning to replace, we ended up augmenting manned submersibles. You've probably heard of the famous submersible Alvin that Woods Hole operated since the 1960s, sending 3 people to the seafloor. And I began working for Dr. Robert Ballard right after he and the team found the Titanic shipwreck in the 80s. And we were bringing online remote robotic technology that allowed us and scientists to sit on the ship and send a teleoperated robot called Jason down to the seafloor with fiber optic cables. And there was a lot of hand-wringing among scientists about, are you really an oceanographer if you don't physically go down to the seafloor and you don't get wet? Exactly. And what ended up happening is the robots were not cheaper and they were not safer. Those were two things that we thought. Those are the kind of traditional narratives of automation from the 20th century. And there's interesting reasons they weren't. But what they did do was fundamentally change the social nature of the experience of exploration. Instead of two scientists going down in Alvin with one pilot coming up and telling everyone what they saw, now you had a room about the size of the studio with 20 people in it exploring the seafloor simultaneously and maybe satellite linked to the shore with another 200 people exploring. And much more complicated story, a lot of people looking over your shoulder, but it turned into a kind of communal experience, a social experience, a kind of real-time scientific seminar of the seafloor. And I learned from that that the robotics changed the social experience of all these different jobs, but not always in ways that are predictable and in ways that we need to pay attention to. And I also came to feel as I came back to MIT after that experience and got my PhD and began teaching that a lot of other fields were experiencing similar kinds of phenomena. But at some level, these extreme environments were just a little bit far out ahead because we had to use robots. We had no choice in a lot of ways. So if you look at oceanography, if you look at space exploration, if you look at warfare, even if you look at flight in the high atmosphere, we can get glimpses of our future with robotics. These are places people deal with robots, automation every day. They're just part of their everyday jobs. And maybe that's how we'll feel with our own driving or factory work and other things in the future. Let's look in those environments and see what our future might be like. And it's fascinating, a little disturbing in some cases, but very much not what you'd expect.
Now, this is a pretty obvious question for you, and it sort of asks you to look into the future. And that's the fact that consumers can have these tiny drones. Companies, corporations can have them. Businesses can use them for delivering and watching traffic. And we know that, well, it's great if you're out in the open plains and you want to make sure everything's right in your ranch and there's nobody out there other than the cattle and the who knows what's out there and a few squirrels. I made that up, obviously. But, you know, sending a drone out to make sure everything's okay and the fences are up and all that, well, that makes perfect sense. But that's one drone not going out all the time. If you're looking in an urban area, there could be all kinds of drones all the time. Do you think that, you know, just when we got to the point where people are putting all the wires underground, which, you know, sprung up in 100 years ago when we had electricity, do you think now we'll be looking up and seeing a lot of drones flying around in cities?
I do think that's a pretty plausible future, although I think there's a lot of things we got to get figured out in order to have that be safe and kind of well-ordered. Again, and you put it beautifully, flying a drone in the desert, and again, most of these drones today are remotely controlled, not autonomous. But even when they're autonomous, flying them in the desert is a relatively well-understood problem. I can build you a drone. High school kid can build a drone off the internet that'll take off, fly a few GPS waypoints and land and do a kind of fully unmanned flight. But it's following those waypoints under the human direction in isolation. So full autonomy tends to work, and it tends to be something you see in these isolated kind of laboratory environments. Bring that same idea into a human setting. Have the same drone flying the same pattern from an airport that other airplanes are using, in airspace that other users are using, whether it's airliners or traffic helicopters or other drones, over people's heads who could be at risk if the batteries fail. And landing at another airport that people are also using. That's operating robotics in proximity to a social setting. We call it situated autonomy. And that's a much more challenging problem. And we can't, till we can crack that problem or even make inroads on it, you're not going to see drones flying around an urban setting. What are the safety issues? What are the control issues? What are the navigation issues? GPS is not a magical panacea. In fact, it doesn't work very well in urban environments when the sky is largely obscured by clouds. How do you have kind of robust local navigation systems that let these things know where they are? What interests me going forward is really how we think about robotics in deep proximity to human environments, whether it's an individual human or an ordinary street scene or a residential neighborhood. And those are the places that we ought to think. Not full autonomy, be out there in isolation in the desert with nobody around you. That's only a modestly interesting problem, and it's mostly been solved. We're interested in how do you bring these things where people are around and they have to be cooperative, safe, trusted, well identified. That's a much more challenging problem. We're only beginning to scratch the surface of.
Now, you've just co-founded Humatics, H-U-M-A-T-I-C-S. What is Humatics?
So Humatics, the name is the first four letters of human and the last four letters of robotics with human first. So we've adopted this human first approach to autonomy and robotics. And as I was just saying, to really think through how are we going to design robotics and autonomy that's trusted, that's transparent, that is responsive not just to the will of an individual user, but responsive within a social environment, sensitive and able to perform in relationship to human environments. And it's a lot of the sort of basic technology that I think will end up being very similar, machine vision, navigation, other things, but deployed in the service of a very different paradigm from full autonomy, the robot that goes out there and doesn't know that it lives in relationship to anything else in the world. And so we're not really a research company. We're not a consulting company. We really want to develop products to enable robotics and autonomous systems to operate in all these ways in human environments, because we're convinced that's the way that they're going to be productive in the world and also supportive of the values that we share.
Well, we started this with talking about you wanting to dispel persistent misconceptions about robots, and we've been all the way along here about particular robots, and I kind of feel like we're in this state now with the drones and all the robots we can do and all the augmented technology we can to anything that moves, which probably fits in that category, that we're in the what-if state. What could we build? It doesn't mean we should. It doesn't mean we're going to. We're kind of like not getting that impact of what would it do to our society to look up and have all these crazy, you know, drones all over the place, and they make noise, and they do. It's like, wait a minute, are we going to tolerate that as a society? Highly unlikely, you know. So this is sort of the next 10, 15 years, really, really important times, it seems, for robotics.
Yeah, I think so. And again, I think, you know, we have choices that we can make. We can go for a world where everything is controlled by, you know, programmers off somewhere before who think they figured it all out before you've seen it. Or what Humatics is doing is pushing for a world where the people are still at the center and we're at control. We have a phrase, instead of automating people out, we're automating people in. What does it mean to automate people in? You know, I'm an engineer. I love all this great technology and, you know, fascinated by all the progress that we've made in computers and semiconductors and sensors and vision and planning and all these things. But I want to put those pieces together in service of a different paradigm from the full autonomy paradigm and toward what we call the perfect five. If you think about autonomy on a scale from one being fully manual to 10 being full autonomy, rather than evolving progress toward full autonomy, which I don't think is really where it's evolving, you know, the true highest form of technology, again, we've solved the full autonomy problem in a lot of settings. The true highest form of technology, very difficult, very challenging problem, is the perfect five. How do we make things that are truly under human control, where, like Neil Armstrong, you can add the autonomy, take it away, bring it in, bring it out, respond to failures, change your mind, change your plans in the most fluid kind of safe way. And there are systems out there that do that. And we're trying to learn from a lot of those systems. The airline system, airliners have their problems, but they're actually very, very safe, although they're quite conservative compared to a lot of other things. So what are those perfect five technologies? How do we have to learn to engineer those? What of the things that have been designed already can we take advantage of? And what new things do we need to build and dream up in order to make perfect five a sort of, you know, we'll never achieve it by definition because it's perfect, but we want to walk down that road and set that as our goal rather than automating people out.
Make it a bigger problem to solve and then solve it better.
It requires different people, different training, different mixes. It's going to be a different kind of company.
Well, David, come back. See us anytime. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much. It's a great conversation.
My guest today is MIT Professor David Mindell. U-matics can be found on the web at umatics.com. His book is Our Robots, Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. It's published by Viking. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about what biotech has been working on for diseases which primarily affect young boys, from hemophilia to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. First up is Paul Perreault, the CEO of CSL. I was reminded that not all biotech companies were founded in the last 10 to 20 years. CSL has been around for quite some time.
Oh, that's right. We have our 100-year anniversary coming up next year. Started in 1916 in Australia as part of the Australian government.
And what was it supposed to do back then?
Well, they were actually founded to supply flu vaccine for the Australian population during the Spanish pandemic. So that's what the government said, well, it's a long way to Australia and we better supply the population here with what we need or else there'll be too many deaths from the pandemic flu.
At that point, it was a part of the Australian government, or it was owned by the Australian government, right?
That's correct. Owned and run by the Australian government up until 1994. And then in 1994, the company was privatized and then taken public and listed on the Australian Stock Exchange.
And here you are, the CEO, sitting in Pennsylvania. How did that work out? How did we get here?
How did we get here? That's a good question. CSL is really a global company, and a lot of our business these days is outside of Australia. Australia is a wonderful place, and I'm there quite a bit because my corporate headquarters are there. I do have a home in Pennsylvania, but actually the company's headquarters for our corporate entity is in Melbourne, Australia. And so I'm in Australia about 100 days a year, about a third of my time, about a third in the U.S. and about a third in the rest of the world because we operate plants all over the globe. We have plants in Australia, in Switzerland, in Germany, in the U.K. and in the U.S.
Now, what do you do today? What is CSL all about?
So our main business today is really in rare diseases and plasma and recombinant proteins.
What does that mean to the average person?
So to the average person, people have probably heard of hemophilia, hereditary bleeding. The gene is passed by the mother to the boys, and the boys contract hemophilia. There are some spontaneous hemophilia that arises in the population, very few. But hemophilia is less than 1% of the total population. So it is a rare disease. In the U.S., for instance, about 20,000 patients with hemophilia. And there are two types of hemophilia. You have hemophilia A and hemophilia B. And basically the difference is the clotting factor or that protein in your blood and plasma that causes the blood to clot. One is factor 8, which is the main hemophilia A population. The factor 9 is a deficiency in hemophilia B. And these factors or coagulation clotting factors are numerous in our blood and in our plasma. And so what we do is we actually make plasma-derived factor 8 and factor 9. So we collect plasma at plasma collection centers in the U.S. We have about 120 plasma collection centers in the U.S. And we take that plasma, we test it, we purify it, we filter it, and we separate the proteins, the factor 8, the factor 9, as well as many other proteins that I'll speak about in just a moment, to actually put those products back into patients to prevent the bleeding. So that's the one aspect of our business, these plasma proteins that we separate from human plasma. recombinant proteins are similar, except they're not made from plasma. They're made from cells that we multiply through
you engineer and multiply.
We engineer and multiply and make factors that way. And we're actually have just submitted a recombinant factor 9 to the FDA. And we have some data coming out next Monday at the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis in Toronto, which will show the benefit that we've submitted to the FDA and hope to have approval by the end of this year.
So what do your new products do, these recombinant engineered proteins?
So they do the same basic thing as the plasma-derived proteins, except they don't come from a human source. And so some people think about human source and say, well, you could have a potential for a virus or a contamination. All these proteins are very well purified, tested, and they're very safe. But the recombinant proteins have the benefit of having long extended half-life. So you can actually reduce the number of doses that somebody needs, and it helps with prophylaxis. So instead of
now,
just
prophylaxis is?
Prophylaxis is treating the patient before the bleed occurs. So because hemophilia particularly is 99.9% boys, and if you have
young boys,
they run around. They want to participate in golf and baseball and be active. And it actually helps prepare their joints and muscles if they do have a bleed. But you want to give the factor before they get on the bus and go to school, because if they have a bleed while they're at school and then they have to be taken to the hospital, the ER, or they have to go home and infuse this factor, it becomes very difficult. And so if you prophylax and give it ahead of time, then you know you're able to sustain. If you do get a bleed, you don't have the serious nature of the bleed that you would have if you just had on-demand therapy, which is just giving the therapy when there's a bleed.
Do you need humans to contribute blood for your new products?
No. So this is made in cells that we engineer in our labs. So we don't need the plasma for that. But in many parts of the world, there are patients that can't afford the recombinant therapies, and there's still a lot of plasma-derived therapies being used because we're able to proficiently extract these proteins, and we can manufacture at a lower cost than the recombinants. So the recombinant therapy is really for, I would say, Europe, U.S., and the emerging countries are still a lot using plasma-derived proteins as well as just on-demand therapy. They're not even doing prophylaxis yet.
This is the reality of the world.
It is. And so we're trying to take that message through. There's probably, in China, for instance, around 75,000 hemophiliacs, but there's only about 5,000 on the national register today. So there's a lot of patients going untreated or not treated at all, or they're only getting it when they have a severe bleed. And that also can cause trouble if they don't get treatment soon enough.
With the engineered treatment, it's technology, so better, faster, cheaper over time. Do you think it will eventually overtake the plasma product?
Well, certainly one of the hardest things we do in the business is to collect plasma. That's a very hard thing to get donors consistently coming into your plasma collection centers and to collect the plasma, to freeze it, to test it, and put it through. So from a throughput perspective, the volume that we can get from a recombinant batch is much better than what it takes to collect the plasma and less costly over time. But we have to build the facilities. We have to, you know, we're building a brand new facility in Switzerland right now to supply all of our recombinant factor 8 that we're submitting shortly to the FDA, our factor 9, and follow on recombinant proteins as well.
Well, you started out 100 years ago with the Spanish flu. Are you still in the pandemic business?
Well, we are in the flu business. We recently announced that we were acquiring the Novartis flu vaccine business.
Oh, yeah.
And so that deal will close sometime this year. And we will become the second largest producer of flu vaccine in the world. And so we did have and do have a manufacturing facility for flu in Australia. Because, again, that's where we started. So it's not the same facility and it's not the same people as 100 years ago. But we have evolved a bit since then. And the Novartis facility has scale that really allows us to participate on a global basis and be a real player in flu. We do have pandemic contracts with the U.S., with BARDA, the biosecurity group of HHS, as well as the UK government and the Australian government. So we do pandemic research and preparedness, as well as seasonal flu, which we will be producing going forward.
Well, Paul, you're a really, really, really busy guy. In the last 5 years, has there been any year where you didn't get a flu shot?
No. In fact, I get two every year. I get one for the Southern Hemisphere and one for the Northern Hemisphere.
Oh, that's right. Two different flus.
That's correct.
Well, if you believe in it, I believe in it. How's
right.
that? Hey, thank you so much. Come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Thank you, Dr. Gunn.
Paul Perreault is the CEO of CSL. More information is available on the web at csl.com.au. An Australian company, let's remember its web address is csl.com.au. Speaking with Shane Kovacs, the CFO of PTC Therapeutics, I asked him to remind us, what is Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
Duchenne is a genetic disorder. It's an X-linked genetic disorder, which means it primarily affects young boys. It's probably the most severe form of muscular dystrophy. And the boys get the disease as a result of a lack of the ability to produce a certain protein called dystrophin. And dystrophin is a protein that lines the membrane of all of your muscle fibers. And it's almost like a spring, and it's a structural protein, and it allows the muscle fiber to withstand the stress of expansion and contraction of the muscle fiber. In the absence of the protein, and these boys don't have the protein, the muscle fibers are much more susceptible to damage. And so just with regular activities, they're constantly damaging their muscle tissue and losing muscle mass. And it tends to you tend to identify these boys at a pretty young age, usually between 3 and 5 years of age, because they're developmentally delayed. They're slow to become walkers, and you tend to have a funny gait as they go up the stairs and whatnot. And it affects first the lower skeletal muscles, but ultimately these boys become wheelchair-bound, usually when they're around the age of 10. And ultimately the disease progresses to the upper skeletal muscles and then ultimately the respiratory and cardiac muscle. And these boys die a premature death usually in their mid-20s.
It's horrific.
Yeah, it's really terrible.
Horrific condition. Now, we've covered several efforts that have been trying to make progress in this area. But what I'm very interested in PTC Therapeutics about is you're trying to do something here with the underlying cause. What is the underlying cause?
Yeah, the underlying cause is the inability to produce this protein dystrophin because they have a mutation in the gene that makes that protein.
Just a random mutation.
There's a number of different mutations that can lead to the loss of the expression of that protein. We're working on a very specific mutation, which is a subset of the boys with Duchenne. It's about 13% on average, and that's called a nonsense mutation. Which is a mutation, which is a single point alteration in the DNA that changes the coding in that DNA and in the messenger RNA from coding for a specific amino acid to now coding for a stop. It's almost like putting a period in the middle of a sentence. And so as the cellular machinery is trying to read that sentence, it stops the sentence prematurely and terminates early. And so you don't produce a full protein.
What did you do?
Well, the company was actually founded 17 years ago by our CEO and scientific founder, Stuart Peltz, who was studying this area of biology and specific these types of mutations called nonsense mutations. And the discovery of our lead drug, Translarna, it's interesting because its mechanism of action, the way that it works, is it binds to the cellular machinery, not to the DNA or the RNA. And when the cellular machinery called the ribosome is reading along the RNA and making the protein, normally when it hits this premature stop codon, it stops and lets the protein go early. Our drug binds to that cellular machinery and tricks effectively the cellular machinery to insert an amino acid at that stop and keep going along reading the rest of the RNA to make the full protein.
Sort of like a patch. we used to say there's a patch in your operating system. Here's a little patch in your...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little patch
in there.
Yeah, it's
interesting. So it inserts one amino acid at that stop, keeps going to make the full protein. And what's really interesting about this drug is it has the potential to treat any nonsense mutation. So it's not necessarily specific to Duchenne. Duchenne's the first indication we're working on, but we're also working on cystic fibrosis and a whole host of other different genetic disorders that are the result of a nonsense mutation.
All right. Let's say that you get good results this fall for Duchenne. How long before people can get it?
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting to that question is we actually got an early approval in Europe about a year ago. So we've already begun commercializing and getting this drug to the boys in Europe. And actually in a bunch of countries outside of Europe, we're now shipping to over 9 countries now, and ultimately will continue to roll out throughout this year. It's in the U.S. where the FDA has asked for us to do this extra study, and so that's the mitigating factor to getting it to the boys here, which we anticipate with a positive study we could be launching in the first half of next year.
Which would be 2016.
2016.
Spring of 2016. What's been the results in the other countries where it's approved?
What we're trying to do is preserve the existing healthy tissue effectively so that the healthy tissue to add the protein and increase its ability to withstand the stress that it would otherwise not be able to. Once the tissue has gone fatty and fibrotic, you're never going to be able to rescue that tissue. So the older the boys are, the more they've lost some of their tissue that you're not going to be able to rescue. So clearly the earlier the better in terms of the treatment. That being said, you still want to try and preserve what the boys have. And so ultimately, we want to try and treat all of the boys, including the young ones, the ones that are still ambulatory, and ultimately even the boys that are non-ambulatory to still preserve what function they have maybe in their upper limbs.
And that's going forward, that we're getting results there.
Yeah. We have lots of great anecdotal stories and feedback from patients, from the physicians, from the boys in terms of, you know, the impact on their activities of daily living in terms of boys are being able to ride their bike to boys being able to stand up in the shower and wash themselves or use the bathroom their own or even boys that are in a wheelchair to be able to use their computer or their wheelchair better. We get that all the time. You know, today we've got over 400 boys, probably pushing through 500 boys now on drug, either in our clinical studies or on commercial reimbursed access. So we've actually got a large number of these boys already on the drug, and the goal is to ultimately to bring it to all of them globally.
Shane Kovacs is the CFO of PTC Therapeutics. More information is available on the web at ptcbio.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.